Very good. Thank you so much this morning. We do use our patriotic songs on occasions such as this. I have behind me a good friend of mine. I thought we met when we were in diapers, but I learned from Jim that it was at four. But my memory's not good at all, so to remember back past that is impossible for me. This man is going to speak to us for 2 hours today. He was involved in the two battles in what is known as the Idrang Valley Campaign that occurred in November of 1965. He was brought into landing zone X-ray, which was memorialized by the movie We Were Soldiers, and did the cleanup job there, and then was engaged in one of the bloodiest battles of the war at landing zone Albany. He will give you a rundown of that second engagement today. He was among 124 who were wounded at Albany. I spoke with him last evening and learned that the casualty rate for those killed and wounded at Landing Zone Albany was around 75%. I'd like you to know that Jim has been blessed by God. He has recently taken a job on the faculty of the University of Alabama. I would also like to introduce to you his better half, a guest with him this weekend, Kathy Lawrence. Please stand, Kathy, so they'll know who you are. Thank you. Jim is a director of the Alabama Center for Real Estate in the University of Alabama's Culver House College of Commerce. That's all on his business card. I do want you to know that it is typical, although not consistent anymore because these guys are getting very old, but they do accumulate in Washington, D.C. on Veterans Day on occasion and go to what is known as Panel 3 East, where they observe the names of those who fell in fray at X-ray and at Albany. And I don't know if you're doing it this year or not, Jim, but sometimes they do it still on Veterans Day. For 37 years, the memory of the two battles at X-ray and Albany causes each of these men to revisit their chaotic 6 days in the sweltering jungles of Vietnam. They remember those whom they called friends and who fell in the fray, and many wonder, as surviving combatants often do, as to why their friend was taken and they were left. I believe the reason some were left is so that they could tell the story. And this is how General Hal Moore described the annual gathering in Washington. In the small closed world of the military, great victories, great defeats, and great sacrifices are never forgotten. They are remembered with battle streamers attached to unit flags. Among the scores of streamers that billow and whirl around the flags of all the battalions of the 1st Cavalry Division, there is one deep blue presidential unit citation streamer that says simply, Pleiku Province. We remember those days, and we remember our comrades. And long after we're gone, that long blue streamer will still caress proud flags. It is my honor and privilege to present to you 1st Lieutenant United States Army, 1st Cavalry Division, 2nd Battalion, Jim Lawrence, fellow Trojan, fellow believer.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much. Believe me, the pleasure is all mine. I did have two administrative announcements to make. Joe made one, and that was to introduce my beautiful bride. So that's done. Secondly, I'm going to be talking to you a lot today, and a lot of questions will come up in your minds. I will have at the end of the second period of time with you a question and answer period. So if something comes up, if you want to jot it down to remember, I will be more than happy to address that at the end of the second hour. And there is no question that is off limits. I think for me to do the duty I need to perform today, then I need to be able to answer your questions, whatever they may be. So I wanted to invite you to do that near the end of the second hour. I want to tell you about the two best friends I've ever had, the two best male friends I've ever had, other than my father and my son, who obviously there's a kinship there, so that doesn't really count in what I'm about to talk about. The first one is your pastor. We did meet about 4 years old. My grandmother Lawrence lived on Church Street in Troy, Alabama. Troy was a little sleepy southeast Alabama town of about 18,000 or so, 15,000 to 18,000. And next door to my grandmother, where my mother and father would dump me off for weekends so they could go to the movies and do other things, they would leave me there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And right next door was a family named Griffin. And Nona and Speed had one child named Joe. And so it was just natural that we become friends. And we did that. When we were small, we would go down to the railroad tracks. And there was a brick wall there by the Goodyear Tire Company. And we'd sit on the brick wall and watch the choo-choo trains. And I said that on purpose, choo-choo trains. That was pre-diesel. And they made that sound. So for those of you under 50, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But we used to love that, and we would sit there, and we bonded. And then as we got older, we'd walk around the corner to, early on, to the Enzo Theater, or through town, which was not difficult. And then later to the Pike Theater, where we met our third friend, Bo Gaylord, who's deceased now, but a dear, dear friend of us both. And we grew up, and we were in Troy High School together. We both graduated from Troy High School, class of 1959. We were both in the band, both played trombones. And I was a better musician than Joe, but it reached time for college, and all my buddies, Joe and Bo and others, were going to the University of Alabama. So our bond and his bond with the University of Alabama goes way, way back. But my mother had different ideas. Two reasons I did not go to the University of Alabama, according to my mother, who, by the way, is 91 years old and still lives in the city of Eufaula, Alabama, on the Alabama-Georgia border. She said, Jim, we're proud of you, but you didn't accomplish what we felt you could accomplish. And so you needed discipline. Now, I'm not because I got in trouble, but I was not self-disciplined. So young people, be aware. If you're not self-disciplined, your mother may send you somewhere you're not crazy about. So keep, make that note. But she said, you need discipline. And secondly, she said, you are from a heritage of military men. You had a great-great-great-grandfather, whose name was Bailey Montgomery Talbot, who was a infantry captain with the 37th Alabama Regiment, who was mortally wounded in the Battle of Peachtree Creek, which is right outside of Atlanta, in the Battle of Atlanta. He was captured as a wounded Confederate, put on a Union prisoner train, taken to Chattanooga, and died in a Union hospital in Chattanooga, and is buried in an unmarked grave somewhere in that city. And then Bailey Montgomery Talbot IV, who is my uncle, my mother's brother, at the time was a Green Beret in Vietnam. This was before the war really heated up. So my mom says, because you've got military in you, and because you need to be disciplined, I'm sending you to the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina. They disciplined me. And I learned there a lot. The two experiences in my life, I think, that were the most important in turning me into a man. The Citadel was one, and the United States military and the experience in Vietnam was the other. I don't recommend the latter, but on the other hand, there are events in our lives that form us, and that was certainly instrumental in my character and my building. I graduated from the Citadel in 1963. And at the time, we had when you graduated from an ROTC program, you had a 2-year regular military commitment. From the Citadel, I could go either Army, Marines, or Air Force. Well, because I knew my heritage, I volunteered for the United States Army. I volunteered for the United States Infantry. I volunteered for the paratroopers. I jumped out of perfectly good airplanes. I volunteered for reconnaissance, and I volunteered for Vietnam. Now, right there, a few of you have just said, this guy is not as sharp as we first thought. But again, there was a purpose in this. I knew what I thought I needed to do and had to do. I went into the Army. My Uncle Bailey, Bailey Montgomery Talbot IV, commissioned me in Troy, and I joined the Army in 1964. I did not know Kathy at the time. I was a single officer. So I was sworn in as a second lieutenant. And I went immediately to Fort Benning. Mark and I talked before the meeting this morning, and Mark was at Fort Bingham. I think, where are you, Mark? He said, four years, and he'll tell you what a lovely place that is. Especially airborne school in July or August, right? After that, you'll go anywhere and fight anybody, believe me. But anyway, so I went to the United States military, and I was in the 2nd Infantry Division, the Indian Head Division for you military guys. We wore a black patch with a star with an Indian head on it. And then about, things started heating up in Vietnam. And in the spring and early summer of 1965, our president, Lyndon B. Johnson from Texas, went on national television. And he said, I am going to create a new division. We're going to call it the 1st Cavalry Division Air Mobile. It didn't exist. The 1st Cav existed, but not the 1st Cavalry Division Air Mobile. And that division was formed by the merger of two units, the 2nd Infantry Division, it's stationed at Fort Benning, and then something called the 11th Air Assault Division. It was an experimental division that had been experimenting with using helicopters as horses. And the UH-1 Huey was our horse, and you still see Hueys today. They look like tadpoles when you see them in the sky. That was our horse. And so we began training, and we had a very short period of time. The 11th Air Assault guys, and it was just guys, ladies, at the time. Women were not in combat armed military. The 11th Air Assault, those guys were battle trained with helicopter training. And that's where the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, came from, commanded by then Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore. And if you've seen the movie, you know the unit I'm talking about. 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, my unit came from the 2nd Infantry Division. We were not as experienced in air mobile concepts, but it didn't matter. President Johnson said, get on the ship and go to Southeast Asia. So we did that. We loaded up in August of 65, sailed out of Charleston, South Carolina, where I'd gone to college, so that was somewhat nostalgic. Sailed through the Panama Canal, went to Long Beach, California, gassed up, because it was easier to move us by ship than by train. Because we had so much gear. And then we went westward across the Pacific Ocean to the South China Sea and to Quy Nhon Harbor in Southeast Asia. It was funny. I was at the time a 2nd Lieutenant Reconnaissance Platoon Leader of Delta Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry. And we knew we had a beach landing. So my recon platoon, we were the 1st Army unit. We all went to a wash-and-dryer place in Columbus, Georgia, and dyed our white underwear olive drab because we knew we'd be in the jungle. So anytime you've seen soldiers with olive drab underwear, I'm going to take credit for that because we were the first ones to do it. And we were also the first ones to wear camouflage uniforms. My recon platoon was a special fighting force, and so we went out and got camouflage uniforms and headed out to Southeast Asia. And when it came time to disembark at Quy Nhon Harbor, we loaded up. We were carrying the M16. We fixed bayonets. We got the machine ready to fire, and we headed down the ramp, and there were the Vietnamese women with leis and selling us drinks and things. So that was our assault to Quy Nhon Harbor. We went overland to a place called An Khe. An Khe is in the central highlands of Vietnam. Now, before I get into the battle, I want to tell you about the second guy. When I was at Fort Benning, you go through infantry officer basic training. And I was, again, a single officer, so I was put in a barracks there near the towers at Fort Benning. And a young man came in after I'd moved in, and he said, hi, I'm your new roommate. My name is Don Cornett. He is Donald Charles Cornett from Lake Charles, Louisiana. He was president of the student body at McNeese State College down there. Don Cornett was married to a beautiful woman named Sylvia, had a child named Kevin. Kevin was about 14, 18 months old. Don Cornett was my roommate in infantry officer basic school. And then we both volunteered for airborne, so we went right from there to airborne school. And so we were roommates again in airborne training. And Mark will tell you get pretty close to whoever you're with at that time because it's an interesting experience. And we were roommates. We stayed down at Lawson Field in the barracks. and went through the 3 weeks of jump school. And so we got tight there. And then we started serving our time in the 2nd Infantry Division. Now, the reason I mentioned that, again, I was a bachelor officer, and Sylvia was one of these kind of women who just, she wanted to mother. That was what she did best. And so every Friday night, she would send word to me through Don, you know, you cannot go to McDonald's. You've got to come over to our house and have a home-cooked meal, similar to the one Joe Henry fixed last 2 nights for us. And so I would do that. Every Friday night, I would go to their officer's quarters at Fort Benning and be fed a great meal, a home-cooked meal. The rest of the time, I was a typical bachelor living in a house with a bunch of other bachelors, and our lifestyles were not exemplary. But anyway, and then Linda Johnson comes on. He says, I'm sending you to Vietnam. So on the troop ship over there, we were together 31 days. And Don Cornett was one of my suite mates on the ship, USNS Maurice Rose, which has now been scuttled. So we got very close. And we knew we were going to war. And Don and I at night, after lights were out and we've made sure our troops were bedded, we'd go up on the top deck of the Rose, the ship, we'd just talk, and he, even though I'm 9 days older than he, my birthday's June the 23rd, he's July the 2nd, he was so much more mature, he was so much more a man and had his act together. I was still immature, the same reason my mother sent me to military college still was there. And I had great respect and admiration for him. And we would sit up there on the top deck and we'd talk. And it was dark. The cinders from the smokestacks would be streaming out the back of the ship. And we talked about everything. We talked about love and life and death and war and combat. And we would imagine what's it going to be like. So we were close. We were very close. We get to Vietnam. We go to An K. We go on some little small field operations. And then in November of 1965, the brass of the division got word that the North Vietnamese were pouring down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And some captured papers indicated that they were going to come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which is from north to south, and then take a left and try to cut the country of South Vietnam in half. That was their strategic plan. And so the 7th Cavalry was given the role of finding and fixing and defeating the enemy. Now, I mentioned the 7th Cavalry to you. We'll talk more about that in the second hour, but it's very significant that you understand who the 7th Cavalry is. The 7th Cavalry existed long before Vietnam and the Idrang Valley, and before and still to this day, the most significant encounter the 7th Cavalry had was in 1876 on a river called the Little Bighorn. That should give you a clue as to the legacy we inherited. And there was a shadow over us. We were aware of what Custer didn't do at the Little Bighorn. He didn't win. And we knew that. And so we were always aware of the 7th Cavalry and what went with that. So in November, in the middle of November, we made our move. We flew from An K in the Central Highlands due west to a place called Pleiku. Joe mentioned the ribbon on the banner. It's the Pleiku province. We called it the Pleiku campaign. It was a province in western Vietnam. 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, flew into a place called Landing Zone X-Ray. That was on Sunday, November the 14th, 1965. They were expecting a battle. Intelligence indicated that the North Vietnamese had been coming down the trail and were cutting through right there. The reason the Idrang Valley was important to them because the Idrang was a river. The word IA in Vietnamese means river, so the river Drang, and they needed water, obviously, and they needed the shelter provided by the trees that would grow near the water. So intelligence indicated that the North Vietnamese were coming down that trail and cutting across right there. Now, you need to understand something. In Vietnam, there were two enemy of our forces. You had the VC, the Viet Cong. The VC were South Vietnamese. they by day were farmers or barbers or something like that. You would pass them in the village of Ankei, and they would speak to you and bow. But at night, they would put on their black pajamas and come sneaking in, trying to sneak into your base camp in groups of two or three. And they would either try to blow up a helicopter or slit your throat while you were sleeping or something to that effect. But they did not want an encounter. They wanted to hit and run. That was the VC at that time. Now, this is early on. You got to understand, this is 1965. We were the first full-size American division to go to Vietnam. So this was very early in the war. So you had the VC, South Vietnamese. But we had not yet encountered the PAVN, P-A-V-N, the People's Army of Vietnam. These were North Vietnamese. These were regular soldiers trained by the Chinese Communists. They wore khaki mustard-colored uniforms. They had a big old silver belt buckle with a big red star. They had pith helmets. They were armed with the AK-47 automatic weapon. They were good. They were good. And that's who was coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So on that Sunday, Colonel Moore takes his 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry into landing zone X-ray. And just moments after they landed, how many of y'all have seen the movie We Were Soldiers? Okay, many of you. The movie's very accurate. We'll talk about that the second hour, and I can answer questions about the movie if you like. But one thing the movie can't do is give the terrain. The terrain was as flat as this right here, the landing zone was. And then on the southern edge of the landing zone, Chupong Mountain went straight up, just like that wall. Almost a 90-degree angle, with fingers coming off of the mountain that led into the clearing called Albany. The North Vietnamese were on the mountain. They've been up there. They've been up there getting ready to go and make the big push to cut the country in half. And here comes Colonel Moore and his 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, and lands at the foot of the mountain, just saying, okay, here we are, come on. Well, that's what happened. The North Vietnamese came pouring down that mountain. And for 2.5 days, 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry put up a fantastic fight defending that landing zone. Now, the movie's a little bit more dramatic, as you can imagine. Randall Wallace, the director and who wrote the screenplay, kept reminding us at the making of the movie, they got to sell tickets. And so, and we'll talk about that the second hour, but the landing zone was never really overrun. There weren't bad guys running through the colonel's command posts and such as that. But still, though, there was a ferocious battle for 2.5 days. It was a lost platoon. It was Henry Herrick's platoon. It was a lieutenant like me. They fought for 2.5 days. They fought from Sunday through Monday and into Tuesday morning. Then on Tuesday morning, they were relieved of their duty on landing zone X-ray. 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, was brought in to replace them. So there's an error in the movie. If you know in the movie when Colonel Moore, with the Mel Gibson character, steps on the helicopter and goes away, the bad guys come down and the North Vietnamese general takes the little flag from the stump. No, if he had done that, he'd have to step over us to get to it. So we go in and we replace them. So the night of Tuesday, the 16th of November, I was on the landing zone. When I first got there, I had walked out towards the mountain because we had monitored their battle by radio. I was about 3 miles away on the landing zone called Atlanta, where the artillery was located. All the landing zones except X-ray were named after cities in Georgia because we came from Fort Benning. There was an Atlanta, there was a Columbus, there was an Albany. And so after we landed, and at the time, Don and I had both been just promoted. About 10 days before the battle, I had been promoted from second lieutenant to first lieutenant and moved from reconnaissance platoon leader to executive officer of Delta Company. For you non-military folks, executive officer is the number two guy in a military unit. Now, that's going to be significant in just a minute. Cornette had just been promoted to executive officer of Charlie Company. All right, so we had companies A, B, C, D, and headquarters. I was the new First Lieutenant XO of Delta. Don Cornette was the new XO, First Lieutenant of Charlie Company. And we go into to landing zone X-ray, and we put our troops in their positions. And so I walked out towards the mountain, and obviously a major battle had taken place there. There were bodies. A dead body in 100-degree heat doesn't keep very well. And they bloat and they turn blackish purple, And it was a sight to behold. I had not seen. I had seen a dead body or two in previous campaigns, but not to this magnitude. And I knew something big had happened here. We spend the night that Tuesday night on the landing zone. And you could look up at the mountain. Now remember, the mountain is like a straight wall going straight. You could see campfires. So we knew there were bad guys up there. But we felt like because of the battle and the job that First of the Seventh had done, we felt like they had been battered enough that they had backed off and were going to give us some space for a while. Then on Wednesday morning, the fateful day of November the 17th, 1965, we got orders to move overland by foot, which is kind of a sore spot with all of us guys because we thought, well, we're the cavalry. Where are the helicopters? Well, the fact of the matter is they were moving other people elsewhere. So we had to move overland by foot to a new landing zone, to landing zone Albany. The reason we were told we were moving was that the B-52s from Guam, met an Air Force gentleman coming in the door earlier, the B-52s from Guam were going to come and carpet bomb Chupang Mountain. And you want to be away. You want to be 3, 4, 5 miles away when that takes place. So we got the orders to move. All right, Joe, I need to see how this goes forward. There we go. Now, you can see our order of march there. You can see where we left X-ray. Column departs 9 a.m. We were led by 2nd Battalion, 5th Cavalry, and then there's 2-7. And we went to the northeast for a couple of miles, and then 2-5 goes on to Columbus, and we take a left. We take a left and head towards landing zone Albany. Now, the significant thing is that we were tired. We had been out there for 3 days. We hadn't eaten much. We had water. You don't sleep when you see campfires on a mountain, and you know it's there are men up there who would kill you if they could. And so we were tired, and one of the things I promise when I make these talks to groups like you is to be honest with you. We did not move tactically. We moved administratively, and that was a mistake. It was a mistake on my part. It was a mistake on the colonel's part. It was a mistake on the captains and the majors and the sergeants' part. We made a mistake. We moved in a column formation. Column means one company behind the other. That's not how you move through jungle terrain with bad guys out there. That is foolish. Now, Charlie Company, for example, Cornett's company had some flankers out on the side. My Delta company did not. We didn't. We were not a rifle company. We were what's called a heavy weapons company. And so we moved administratively. Colonel McDade, who was our brand new battalion commander, great guy. But he'd been in a desk job in Saigon until right before all the reassignments, and he became our new battalion commander. He was not a Hal Moore. He would never be played by a Mel Gibson character in a movie. Great man, nice man, but maybe in the wrong place at the wrong time. So we're moving through the jungle. The jungle is not like in Tarzan movies. There weren't alligators and swamps. It was just sometimes it would be somewhat open. There was elephant grass. Elephant grass is about this tall. It's a very tough grass. It stands straight up. It'll cut you if you were to slide on it, for example. And then there were, when the area was open, there would be long trees with tall stalks, and then they would canopy. They'd grow together at the top. And then we got into the real heavy growth. There'd be deadfall, dead trees lying horizontal, and more growth, and then more bushes and brambles and such. And we just, that's what we were moving through. And it was a tough walk. It was 100 degrees. We made some mistakes. First is the way we moved and the way we moved when we took that left towards the landing zone. Second mistake, my old recon platoon was point, and then A Company was up in the front. One of the platoons from A Company came across a straw hut. a pretty big hut. It was on stilts. And the North Vietnamese had stored rice and wheat and a few things in that straw hut. Well, somebody in that platoon of A Company decided to put a Zippo to it and light it up, destroy it so they couldn't use it. Well, if you light up a straw hut in the jungle, what does it do? It sends up a big plume of smoke. We announced our coming. The North Vietnamese, two units that had not been involved in landings on X-ray, had just crossed the Cambodian border 3 miles to the west and moved on to the banks of the I Drang River. You see where the river is, just north of Albany, the 33rd and the 66th regiments. There were about seven of them to every one of us. They figured out we were heading towards that clearing. They began to move and move quickly to deploy around the clearing that we dubbed Landing Zone Albany. This was right before noon on the 17th of November. We were moving in our column formation. It was A Company, my Delta Company, Cornette's Charlie Company, and then headquarters and another attached unit. Two prisoners, my old recon platoon, ran across two prisoners. They were actually a listening post. We didn't know that until later. History told us later they were there on purpose to be captured. My old recon platoon jumps on two North Vietnamese in a foxhole and captures them. Immediately, the Colonel McDade, stops the column, stopped in place. And the word came back, okay, we've captured two prisoners. Stop where you are. It's noontime. If you want to take a little administrative break, go ahead. If you want to open some cans of rations, line them if you got them. Guys were dropping helmets. They were dropping backpacks. We were tired. They were plopping down on the ground, taking a nap, a break. Now, we're in the middle of bad guy territory. We don't know what's around us, and we've stopped the column. When the column stopped, I could see to my left front a clearing. I assumed that was Landing Zone Albany. I don't know. When we stopped the column, one thing you need to understand about the terrain right in here, it was just like I described. It was flat with the elephant grass, and it was pretty open here with the big tall trees that canopied. But to my right, as we were marching this way, to my right, no more than a football field's length was this green barrier, a wall of underbrush and trees and growth, and it was just thick as it could be. You couldn't see through it. You couldn't see light through it. We had nobody on the other side of that green barrier, but the North Vietnamese were lining up, and they were climbing trees. And we were stopped. And I remember thinking, this is strange. This is a strange feeling here. We're taking a break. And we saw them on the mountain. We knew they were still out there somewhere, but it just something. Well, about that time, the colonel and the command group is moving forward to the landing zone. And we're stopped. And he then makes a radio call, and he says, I want all the company commanders to come forward with your radio operator so I can disperse the troops. I can tell you where I want you to go around the landing zone. So my company commander, Captain Henry Thorpe, and his radio operator go forward. Cornette's company commander, Skip Festmeyer, captain, goes forward. So now here's what you've got. You've got spread out south of Albany, southeast of Albany, a military unit in column formation, stopped, taking an administrative break, and all the companies were beheaded. The captains were all called forward. It's about 1:15 now on that Wednesday. I'm going to read from a great book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, by Joe Galloway and General Moore. And let me just read a paragraph to you to set you up now for what's about to happen. The most savage one-day battle of the Vietnam War was about to begin. While many of Colonel McDade's troopers lay in the grass resting, North Vietnamese soldiers swarmed towards them by the hundreds. A deadly ordeal by fire was beginning in the tall elephant grass around Albany and along the column of American troops strung out through the jungle, waiting for orders to move. It was 1:15 p.m., Wednesday, November the 17th. By the time the battle ended, in the pre-dawn darkness the next morning, 155 American soldiers would be dead and another 124 wounded. Those who survived would never forget the savagery, the brutality, the butchery of those 16 hours. I was standing there at 1:15, looking towards that green wall. There was something ominous about that green barrier. In the meantime, we had two units that had deployed. And you can see where it may be not too clear, but you see the clearing. You see A Company. You see D Company. That's where I am now, at D Company. You see, there, I'm right there. The green wall is right there. There's the clearing. There's Albany. And a platoon from A Company and a platoon from A Company and Recon, my old Recon platoon. Cornet's right here, Charlie Company. The way they did the ambush, it was either called a U-shaped or a L-shaped ambush. The concept being when they let you into it, and then once you touch the mouth or the base of the ambush, they open fire. That's what happened. Either the recon platoon, but more than likely one of the platoons from A Company, went into the woods on the other side of the clearing. And I remember standing there thinking, just we were tired and the men were down and I forgot to mention one of the terrain features that's very significant are the ant hills or the termite mounds. Now I know you think of an ant hill in one way. These things were about from that floor about this tall. They were hardened. They were hard as this, and they were shaped conical. And that's a great place to hide behind. They were all over the place. These big termite mounds or these ant hills we call them. It was 1:15, and I'm standing there, and all of a sudden, way off to my left front, towards the clearing, I hear, brr, which is an automatic weapon. And my first thought was, what in the world? What are they doing? They don't need to be shooting guns out here in the jungle. That announces where we are. And that thought lasted just a moment. And then that green wall exploded. Machine gun fire, automatic weapons fire, hand grenades, mortar fire just exploded. It just erupted. And I remember going to the ground, incredible feeling. There's no way that I can describe to you the fear that takes you at a moment like that, because you're not expecting it. Even though you say, well, you're out in the jungle and you were in war and you were armed, still though, the surprise and the shock, you're almost in shock. And we went down and immediately started returning fire to our right, because we knew where it was coming from. And it's really funny when a battle like that happens, your whole world comes right here and you think you're the only one being shot at. And I get on the radio. Now, keep in mind, I'm the executive officer of Delta Company, a first lieutenant, 24 years old. Commander's been called forward. I'm in charge of this company that's now in a killing zone of an ambush. I didn't know that at the time. I just thought we were being shot at. So I get on the radio and I try to raise somebody up front saying, hey, we're being shot at. We need help. Well, that's what everybody was radioing, because the whole column was getting hit from the right and front. And one thing about the North Vietnamese, they figured out very quickly. You got to remember something. We had two advantages they did not have. We had the advantages of artillery and air power. They had no air force. They had no artillery pieces big enough. So their concept was grab the Americans by the belt buckle. Close with the Americans quickly so they cannot use the artillery and the air. And so immediately they came charging out of that green hedge. And I can close my eyes and see them just as clear today as I did in November. They came charging out of that hedge and we started firing and they were firing at us. I'll never forget. There was an ant hill about as far from where I am to Joe. And this one North Vietnamese comes running up behind the ant hill and he throws a grenade over the top of it, lands about as far from me to right there. But their grenades were wooden, filled with black powder. They were psychological grenades. They just exploded, and black powder and splinters went everywhere. And that was it. And it exploded, and I pointed it to get, I said, Sergeant Baker, he's right there. He's behind that anthill. And Baker gets up and runs around and kills him. And then there's one coming at me, and he was just running right at me. And I fired, and he went down like a man who's tied to a rope, running full speed, and the rope goes taut and just stops dead. He went down, and And this thing is getting crazy, and it's so fast, and you have no concept of time, and you don't know. I mean, a minute becomes a second, or an hour. I mean, it's wild. The noise is unbelievable. I don't know why we had radios. We couldn't hear anybody on them. We couldn't talk to anybody. I will tell you about that moment in time. We get a call from Colonel McDade, who says, "Ceasefire, ceasefire. We're killing our own people." Now I'm watching North Vietnamese running at me, and I get a ceasefire order. Well, this brand new first lieutenant disobeyed the command of a colonel in combat. Now that's usually, you go to jail for that, but it was just crazy. And they were coming at us and we were shooting them. And about that time, I'm in the prone position firing to my right. And we all were, and they were running at us. And about that time, I realized, I had a thought. I said, "Lieutenant, you're in charge of this company. And they trained us at Fort Benning. When your unit is in a kill zone, your job is to get them out of it." So I knew that my job was to get this company out of the kill zone. And I had this thought, and I told you I'd be honest with you. I said to myself, "Okay, I need to talk to the personnel officer. I want to resign." I don't want this job as of right now, because I knew what I would have to do. I knew that I would have to get up and move this group of men. Now, the North Vietnamese had a layer of automatic weapons fire about 4 feet. There were interlocking fires, called interlocking fire, machine gun fire, and automatic weapons fire. And if you stood up, you were just stepping into solid steel coming at you, and would just tear your body apart. But I knew that I had men in the kill zone. And it's a job I didn't want, but I didn't have a choice. Now, how long did that thought last? 5 seconds. I don't know. So I start to get up. I put the butt of my M16 on the ground. I raised up above the elephant grass. And just as I did, I saw a movement to my top left up in a tree. It was a North Vietnamese machine gunner tied in a tree. He saw me coming up. He aimed. He fired. I was a paratrooper. I had a steel pot on with a helmet liner under it and what's called a sponge donut that paratroopers wear so it doesn't cut the back of your neck when you jump out of an airplane. And I had it buckled down. He put 2 rounds in the helmet right here, and he exited right here. 2 small holes in the front, 2 jagged holes in the back. It clipped the webbing on the helmet liner, which means it missed the top of my head about 1/2 of an inch. I never bled. It never broke skin. But the impact was like getting hit in the head with a sledgehammer. I went straight backwards. I went down. I can't describe the feeling, but I remember Sergeant Bowen telling us, and he knew this, I don't know, but he told us back at base camp one time, he said, the wound that kills you, you don't hear. And he said, and if you get shot in the head, don't reach up and feel it. And I knew the top of my head had been shot off because I went completely numb. And I went down, and I had this thought. I said, "Mama, I'm sorry. I have a little sister. My mother and father are still in Troy, and my little sister is 6 years younger than I. I said, Mama, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Mama. Your only son has been killed in Vietnam." And I kept having that thought. And at that point in time, I didn't care about the battle. I knew I was dying. Something amazing happened. I didn't die. And Sergeant Baker comes over and shakes me and says, "Lieutenant, we got to get out of here. We got to get out of here. We're being overrun." And I remember thinking, I didn't say it, but I thought, I said, "Sergeant Baker, leave me alone. Can't you see that I'm dying?" And by this time, the North Vietnamese are running past us, and you can feel them whoosh through the elephant grass, and you can hear their high staccato language that they spoke. And what you would hear was, you'd hear them run past and stop, and then hear maybe an American say, "No, no, no," and then the report of a pistol. They were executing the wounded. They had no capacity to take prisoners. And And I'm down, and I gave an order. I was by a tree. It was being hit on three sides. And I gave an order. The only order I gave was to Sergeant Baker. I said, move the men that way. And I pointed in the direction where the tree wasn't being hit, which made sense to me. Plus, I knew we were trying to get to the landing zone. They said, what about you? I said, I can't move my legs. They said, we'll drag you. I said, just go. He said, no, we'll drag you. So they dragged me part of the way. I don't know who was dragging me. He got shot because they dropped me. And they dropped me near the clearing. So they moved me from the column of trees near the clearing. And I'll show you that now. That's this slide. You see how the North Vietnamese had now run between us? And they were dragging me from here to here. But the man carrying me was shot. And I went down. And now I'm in elephant grass, but in a more clearing area near the edge of the landing zone. And by this time, the gentlemen, the men in the landing zone, had gotten the Air Force online. And the forward air controller had called in air support. Now, for those of you who are Air Force-oriented, you would understand that we had some good jets over there, the Phantom, for example. But in this case, the exact right airplanes showed up. It was the old A1E Sky Raider. It's a propeller-driven airplane, fully loaded with napalm and bombs and rockets. And there were two of them. And if you've ever seen a crop duster at work, that's exactly how they were flying. The North Vietnamese would charge across the clearing. The A1Es would clear the trees and then sit down and unload. And they would literally cook the North Vietnamese as they came across the clearing. But I'm lying near the clearing to the point that when they would unload their napalm, the elephant grass around me would do this. It was that hot. And I'm having this thought. I'm not dying, but I'm about to be killed by my own Air Force. And I've got to continue moving. I could move my arms. I couldn't move my legs. I had a spinal injury. And so I was face down, and I used the helmet as a slide, and I would grab elephant grass and pull, and grab elephant grass and pull, and grab elephant grass and pull. I have no idea how far I went, have no idea how much time it took. Next thing that happened, somebody grabbed me under my armpits, and that scared me as bad as getting shot. It was a medic, an African-American, who dragged me the rest of the way into the copse of trees that was inside. There were some trees inside the clearing right there where you see the flag. That's where they made their stand. And I was dragged into that. My battle was over. North Vietnamese continued to assault. They had broken through the companies in the back of the column. Charlie Company got hit the worst. I spent the rest of that afternoon and that evening. The battle had begun to subside by that time. There was sporadic fire around the clearings. Night came, but we knew the enemy was still out there, so they had an Air Force plane always orbiting us, dropping flares. And I remember spending the night watching the flares come down, and the flares would make the trees dance, and I spent the entire night watching the trees dance. It was fascinating. Had no idea when we'd get out. I didn't get taken out until the next morning. We couldn't get helicopters in. The next morning, battle was over. Hughes and Chinooks came in. They took out the dead and the wounded. The men who were still able policed the battlefield. Larry Gwynn, who was the XO of Alpha Company, told me it's the worst day of his life, policing the battlefield the day after the battle. They put me on a helicopter to a field hospital at Pleiku. They put me on an airplane to a bigger hospital at Quy Nhon. It was hectic because all the wounded were coming in at the same time. They did an x-ray of my neck. A doctor came in a hurry because he was going from one patient to the other. He said, your neck's been severed. Your spine's been severed at your neck. We're putting you on an airplane to Clark Air Force Base Hospital in the Philippines. I was smart enough to figure out that if my spine had been severed, I was paralyzed for the rest of my life. They put me on the airplane. They sent me to Clark Air Force Base. It was outside of Manila. Hospital there was sophisticated. I saw my first American nurse in 4 months, and she was absolutely gorgeous. It didn't matter what she looked like. Her name was Lieutenant Case. They wheeled me up at midnight to the check-in counter, and she leaned over, and she said, "Welcome to Clark Air Base Hospital, Lieutenant." I still had on the clothes I had in the battle. I went through, they did x-rays the next day. They said, "No, your spine has not been severed. It's been bruised. And with rehabilitation, you will come through this." I spent 2 months there. It was a wonderful experience. Bob Hope Show came through. I had Anita Bryant sing to me. I've got a picture of that. Joey Heatherton was with the Bob Hope group, and Carol Baker. And Mr. Hope came into my hospital room. Vice President Hubert Humphrey was visiting, and he came up to my hospital bed, and an AP photographer was with him, and he took a picture of the Vice President shaking my hand. And all it said was, it was an error actually in the caption, it said, "Lieutenant James Lawrence, Marine, Troy, Alabama, greeted by Vice President Humphrey." Well, my mom and dad start getting letters from all over the country addressed to the parents of Lieutenant James Lawrence, Troy, Alabama. No zip code, no nothing. And she's got a stack of them. And they were right on the picture. "Is this your boy? We're praying for him. Thank you for his service." Just stuff like that. I spent my 2 months there in rehabilitation. I went back to Vietnam to finish my two-year tour. I couldn't leave that place on a stretcher. Crazy as that sounds, it didn't make sense, but I had to go back. And last thing I'll tell you before we take our 10:30 break, is that correct, Joe? About 100 yards behind me when I was wounded, Don Cornett was trying to rally the C Company troopers to get them out of the killing zone as well. He was shot in the foot. First, half of his right foot was taken off, and then he was shot in the back twice, and he died. And I share that with you because I will end the second part of the talk this morning, and I will tell you my thoughts and philosophies of war, but I will tell you that what Hal Moore says every time he finishes a speech, and he says this: war is horrible. He says, "Hate war, but love the American warrior." And that's a message. If you remember nothing else today, I want you to remember that. Hate war, love the American warrior. When I go to the wall in Washington, and I go there often, I was there a week ago, because we buried Captain Spires in Arlington last week. I go to the wall, and I go to Don's grave in Arlington. When I go to the wall, when you go to the wall, you see 58,000 plus names. When I go to the wall, I see Don Cornett's name 58,000 times, because every name on that wall had a mama and a daddy, maybe a spouse, maybe a kid, aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters. Don Cornett had a beautiful wife named Sylvia who lives in Houston, Texas, and a beautiful 18-month-old son named Kevin who died of a heart attack 2 years ago exercising. And I went to his funeral at Sylvia's request. And she told me as I left Houston, and probably the last time I'll ever see her, she said, "Jim, I've just lost my last connection with Don Cornett. That's my son, Kevin. Hate war, but love the American warrior." Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. We will break. The doors will be open to my right, and there will be halftime, we call it, refreshments. Also be aware that after the second session, there will be a luncheon served in the same area. I would like to show you a CD of Jim's that he has recorded called Reflections on Albany. There are several of them at the bookcase if you'd like to take one. They are the readings of several free verse poems that he's written about his experiences in this battle and its aftermath. You're dismissed for halftime. We'll reassemble at 10 till.